Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable. Ah.
Hey there, if you're listening to this and you support us on Patreon, you can hear it via the Patreon page ad-free. You're listening to Sound Opinions, and this week we're talking with author R.J. Smith about Chuck Berry. I'm Jim DeRogatis.
And I'm Greg Kot. We'll dig into the good and bad sides of Berry's legacy. But first, we have to pay tribute to the queen of rock and roll, Tina Turner.
You're right, Greg. It's not that the world has been hurting for wonderful tributes to this magnanimous, fantastic, iconic star. They've been everywhere. We got the news right when we were wrapping up taping a week or so ago. We rushed out a tribute podcast paying tribute to Tina Turner, but she deserves time on the radio show as well. Tina Turner, where do you even start?
First of all, with Tina, the thing that needs to be right up front is what a groundbreaking artist she was. Everybody kind of knows the Ike and Tina Turner story and the abusive relationship, and you know that's kind of the public image that she's been saddled with. But to me, the most fascinating part of her career was the reinvention of Tina Turner, engineered by one Tina Turner, because nobody really wanted to sign a woman of color in her mid-40s in the mid-80s. I mean,
no.
It was the MTV era. You know, Tina Turner, old news, right? What happened to her? We don't really need to sign Tina Turner. We've got all these much younger acts coming up the pipeline to fill the MTV airwaves.
And
you know?
Starting out with a country record when she tried to come back originally, which was clearly not, you know, her strength, and then to succeed the way she did. Armloads of Grammys, acting roles, hit singles. Yeah, Tina came back in a big way.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, the huge hit was, you know, What's Love Got to Do With It on the Private Dancer album in 1984. And, you know, when I interviewed her years after that, she said, I hated that song.
Yeah.
She goes, I did not like it. It's this eensy teensy song. I've been covering Jumpin' Jack Flash by the Rolling Stones in concert. I wanted to do rock and roll. What's this song? And she said, what turned it around for me is I'm driving through L.A., and a woman in a passing car, we're at a stoplight, and a woman in a car, she rolls down the window and says, what's love got to do with it? All right! Gives her the thumbs up. And Tina goes, that's when I realized she's talking about, you know, you're liberated. You can love who you want to, when you want to.
Right.
And it really gave me a whole different perspective on the song and what it meant to this young woman. You know, made me realize what I was singing and that people got it. They understood where I was coming from, as a woman and as a somebody who was reinventing her career. Beyoncé's and the Rihanna's and the Taylor Swift's of the world filling arenas now.
Yeah.
That wasn't done back then. A woman of color filling a rock arena or stadium as Tina Turner was by the late 80s, early 90s was pretty unprecedented. Pioneering, in that regard. So everybody who's you know, doing really well on tour these days, you know, especially women,
yeah,
owe Tina quite a bit because of what she did, the road that she paved. So that's the first thing I want to get across. I mean, there's a whole history here, Jim, that we can take on. But I just think her groundbreaking efforts need to be recognized up front.
You're absolutely right. And before we get away from that woman rolling down the car window, back in 86, Tina told Rolling Stone, "My songs are a little bit of everybody's lives who are watching me. Mm-hmm. You got to sing what they can relate to. And there are some raunchy people out there, or the world is not perfect."
Yeah.
All of that is in my performances. I think that's a brilliant quote. Anna Mae Bullock, everybody knows, born 1939, Brownsville, Tennessee, northeast of Memphis, spent her early years on the Poindexter farm in Nutbush. Famous quote, often repeated, "We were well-to-do farmers," Tina Turner said, until World War II comes along and the family has to relocate to Knoxville for a time. Tina's parents did not have an easy marriage, and of course, Tina Turner didn't. She said, was often asked, and she spoke honestly about that horrible relationship with Ike Turner, who was abusive, who was a drug addict. And she said, "Every time I have to tell the story, I'm reliving that."
Mm-hmm.
But she told the story because she knew other people drew strength from it. She was still a teenager. Still in high school when she went to see Ike Turner and his Kings of Rhythm. Now, Turner, you know, in 1951, under a different name, it was Ike Turner and the Kings of Rhythm, but under Jackie Brenston and his Delta Cats, they released what is generally considered 1951 as the first rock and roll record, Rocket 88. And they were a great pair on stage. You know, Ike had always said, "I wanted vocals like Little Richard," and he got much, much more from Anna Mae Bullock. You know, you begin to dig into the great obituaries. New York Times did a great one. Rolling Stone, of course, I've read Tina's autobiography. How did Anna Mae Bullock become Tina Turner? Well, she married Ike for the last name. She was enamored with the movie serial Sheena, Queen of the Jungle.
Yeah.
And so Sheena became Tina.
Right. Sheena is a punk rocker. Tina is a soul dynamo. One thing she always said to me is that the recordings were just sort of like a dress rehearsal for the stage show. That's where those songs really took on a second life. And thankfully, we have plenty of video footage of Tina, you know, in her Ike and Tina days performing.
Great footage.
You know, I mean, performing like dancing and singing simultaneously like her hair is on fire.
Dancing
in high heels.
Dancing doesn't quite do justice to the gyrations on stage. I got to confess, a lot of those 80s hit records I thought were overproduced. And then seeing her perform live, that was where, you know, you really heard the soul of Tina Turner.
Well, you know, and I got to say, the 60s stuff that she did, you know, those were blazing songs. I mean, I thought that, you know, the harder edge stuff was just amazing.
But there's just one thing, you see. We never, ever do nothing nice and easy. We always do it nice and rough.
And I really appreciate the fact that a lot of rock performers got it. You know, they were like, they're amazing. The Stones had them opening for them in 69, and
not only
Mick Jagger is standing at the side of the stage with his jaw hanging open.
He's taking notes. He is taking notes.
Kidding.
I love the Phil Spector single. It's controversial, River Deep, Mountain High. But, you know, Tina loved it. She said in her 86 memoir, "First time in my life, it wasn't just R&B. There was structure. There was melody. I was a singer, and I knew it could do other things." And, man, that's one of the all-time. I think if you had to stock a jukebox with only a dozen singles, that would be on there for me.
Yeah, Yeah, it was a towering achievement. Spector, of course, was disappointed that it didn't go number one.
Yeah.
But, you know, you're right. Tina would say, you know, Phil respected me as a singer. Mm. The unsaid flip of that was that Ike really didn't want me singing. He wanted me up there belting my lungs out.
Phil Spector, also an abusive husband.
Yeah.
Man.
Yeah, boy, some trouble that Tina went through. And, you know, raised four kids, you know.
Yeah.
And she told me that one of the reasons she waited so long to get out of this abusive relationship is she wanted to make sure the kids got out of school.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she wanted to see them through that. And then she left and basically derailed, you know, her life and her career.
She left in 1976 mm-hmm. with 36 cents mm-hmm. and a gas card
right.
in her pocket.
Right.
I didn't know this, but Anne Margaret, who she'd been in Ken Russell's film version of Tommy by The Who, Anne Margaret put her up for a couple of weeks to get on her feet and really helped her. And that was that's an interesting side note there.
Yeah, no, it's interesting that people took note of it. You know, I think she was gone, but never really truly forgotten. I mean, the guys in Heaven 17, you know,
that was the
did
beginning
some
of the
collaborations
comeback.
With her in the early 80s. I mean, who would have thunk it, right?
The beginning of the comeback was recording with Heaven 17, and that's a great single.
It is, because here we are, you know, they're on top of the game then with the synth pop era and the, you know, the whole new romantic movement, and they bring Tina in, say, you know, you got us. We're the reason we're doing this.
Well,
you know?
How do you make the Temptations Ball of Confusion better?
Yeah.
Tina Turner.
Yeah.
Okay, that's the only way you can, right?
That's right, and they did an Al Green cover, which I think she brought back again on her early solo records. You know, she kept the flame lit. She was never ready to quit. And I think one of the big issues is that nobody at the major labels or any of the record companies really understood what they were going to do with her. Like, okay, as I said, you know, you're a woman in your mid-40s of color, and what are we going to do with this? And she really did have to push, and start over again. Can you imagine starting over again at that age after the success that she'd had? And she did it. You know, the fact that she was able to sort of reinvent herself. And I remember going to those shows in the late 80s, early mm-hmm, 90s, mm-hmm. when she had come out with the solo records. And I thought, the solo records are okay. I like some of those songs.
It's that 80s production.
It's, you know, they're pop songs that were perfect for the day. But, man, the stage show was still on fire. She was absolutely a dynamic performer right to the time she stopped touring.
I thought the live shows brought those songs to life. I'd never have to hear the recorded versions again. You know, interestingly, Greg, you know, we didn't even mention Mad Max, right?
Mm-hmm, right, right.
You know, Tina said she preferred, later in life, she preferred acting to singing
mm-hmm,
because she could step into another role. Mm. And as much as she loved singing, I thought that was a, you know, wow, to have a voice, that gravelly, soulful voice that she had. And I guess I'd rather act, but I'm happy to have this success in music. You know, also successful, I think this is inspiring. In 1986, she meets a German music executive, Erwin Bach. They became a couple. They lived in Germany for a time, but she died in Switzerland. They were living in Switzerland for decades. And true happiness finally seems to have come to her late in life. He was there at her deathbed.
Yeah, it was great for her. You know, she was a very private person. She did have this public persona, and there was a private side to her. And, you know, she didn't really want people to feel sad for her or pity her in any way. She just sort of said one day she announced, you know, I'm not going to tour anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And you sort of go, okay. Mm. You know, she lived for that stage. And you just thought, okay, maybe things aren't going so well. You know, it turns out she had a stroke. She had cancer. She was dealing with all sorts of health problems
Kidney
in the
failure.
Last decade. Yeah, it was rough. But at the same time, she went quietly. But what a remarkable legacy she left. And I think, as you said, people can take comfort from the fact that she did reinvent herself, not only as an artist, her life.
Yeah, a survivor.
And it was a happier ending than a beginning for her in
That's
so
for
many
sure.
ways.
Well, so if we have to play one song, what would it be?
Well, that's a great, question because, you know, I don't really want to revisit the Ike and Tina days.
No.
As much as I admire the music from that era, there's so much baggage associated with that. You know, I really like that song Better Be Good to Me. From the comeback record.
Yeah.
You know, it's either that or I Might Have Been Queen, but I think Better Be Good to Me, just the way she sings that, you know, and it's almost like, okay, I'm not going to take it anymore. Nobody's
right.
ever going to treat me like that ever again.
Yeah.
Better Be Good to Me from Tina Turner on Sound Opinion.
Better Be Good to Me from Tina Turner, dead at the age of 83, rewrote pop music over the last half of a century. That is our tribute to Tina Turner, and now we want to hear from you. Share your opinions via voice message on our website, soundopinions.org. Coming up next, we talk with R.J. Smith about the rock and roll pioneer Chuck Berry on Sound Opinions. Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island. Since 1988, Goose Island has been brewing award-winning beers in Chicago that are inspired by this city. Take 312 Lemonade Shandy, Tropical Beer Hug Double IPA, and a rotating series of hazy IPAs only available in Chicago. Every time we go down to Goose Island, there's another one that they're pushing on us.
That's right.
They're all good.
Absolutely. And what supporters of musical culture, you know, in the city of Chicago and elsewhere, if you go to a show in Chicago and you see that Goose Island sign, you know when you're in good hands. They're music fans as well as great beer makers at Goose Island, so we're really proud to be associated with them.
The Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago's beer.
Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island. Since 1988, Goose Island's been brewing beers in the spirit of Chicago.
You can find IPAs, lemonade, shandy, and limited releases in-store or at one of Goose's venues in Chicago. Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago's beer.
And we're back. We really enjoy talking with authors who have dedicated years to deep research on topics we love. That's why author R.J. Smith is back with us on the show today. His latest book on Chuck Berry is a stunning feat of music journalism.
You are absolutely right, Greg. R.J.'s 2012 book on James Brown, The One, warranted a great conversation. Prompted a great conversation on Sound Opinions way back, episode 362. And Chuck Berry, An American Life, is equally as memorable and powerful. But when you're looking at a new book on a star as well-known as Chuck Berry, you have to ask, what more is there to say, especially at a point where the controversy is sort of on an equal level to the accomplishments?
Exactly. I began our interview by asking R.J. what more there was to say about Chuck Berry and James Brown.
Both those people wrote books, and Chuck's autobiography is wonderfully written and is revealing in all kinds of personal ways. There's almost nothing about the music in Chuck's autobiography, which is fascinating and meaningful and frustrating. And both those artists shape their story, which is their right and their desire, and it's valuable on its own. But they told far from the whole story about their lives. And also, in the greater pool of things that have been written about both those people, there's some good reporting out there. There's some good criticism and musical analysis out there. And it's never been put together, to my mind, at least in a really strong through line, bringing the two sides together. That's something that always interests me when I approach a subject. That's a good start.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you pulled it off. I think that the bringing in the life of Chuck and how it what it meant to his music. Your analysis of the music is fantastic.
And, it is. Yeah.
And it needs to be said, because I don't think enough people appreciate just how innovative and how incredible those songs were. But the flip side of that, the personal side of Chuck, and I want to get back to the music. In reading your book, it just underlines what I had thought all along, how inscrutable this guy is. How does anyone ever get to know Chuck Berry?
One of his love interests says, I still can't decide if there was no there, or if just there was a there that we would never know.
Yeah, he didn't want to spill the beans, give the secret sauce. And I think there was something about his upbringing that put some guilt in him for being the kind of success he was, being the artist that he was. There was not enough room for that, I think, in his family and in his community growing up. And, you know, I'm from Detroit. I'm from the Midwest. There's definitely a certain rising above your raising kind of vibe. Hmm. So Chuck did not want to talk about being an artist. He wanted to talk about making stuff. He made songs. Mm-hmm. He followed a formula, is how he would put it. But obviously, he was as much an artist as anybody's ever been.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, RJ, the most profound sentence comes late in the book, page 327. Racism and sexual freedom fused, moving with him wherever he played. You make a very convincing case throughout the book that he was hounded by white authorities, targeted, you know, the second most celebrated target of the Mann Act, transporting a minor for sexual exploitation across state lines. He's now been joined by a third, Robert Sylvester Kelly, brought low by the same thing, by the same two things, by videotaping his encounters throughout his life and by violating the Mann Act. Let's start with the racism. This guy had a target on his back, and it was relentless, which is not to excuse the other stuff, which we'll talk about.
Yeah, no, he certainly did, and he stuck his neck out. He didn't invite it, but he met it head on. You know, there was if you said don't stand on that spot on stage, he would stand on that spot on stage.
Right,
And if the law enforcement officer said don't talk to that white woman, he would seek her out.
Yeah.
So there was a target on his back. St. Louis is a border state. There was definitely segregation in the city and the state then. He wanted to reach white audiences. A collision was inevitable. And he did not shrink from that collision. As a teenager, he was in prison for 3 years. He was followed by the police when he was a pop star. His car was pulled over all the time. He did have a target on his back. And as you say, and the Mann Act, which we will, I'm sure, probably talk about, he did heinous stuff. But the Mann Act prosecution was also a heinous thing done to him.
By a biased judge, yeah.
Yes, yes. So he was never tried for crimes that perhaps he should have been tried for. So he was a victim and a victimizer.
Yeah, you know, RJ, what kills me, I teach a class for two sections of 150 first-year students each, music and media in Chicago, right? We look at Chess Records, part one, you know, Muddy Waters and the Blues, part two, the invention of rock and roll that happens with the Chess Brothers, Chuck and Bo Diddley and Etta James. And such is the political climate today that my students, when they realize what Berry was convicted of and accused of, not always the same thing. You know, I don't believe in this phrase, cancel culture, because R. Kelly was not canceled. People made a conscious decision. I will not support with my dollars this man who is causing so much pain for 30 years in my community, right? But Berry is a hard one. You know, Greg and I wrestled and felt miserable and horrible. We talked about him when he died on the show. It was really difficult, you know. So the million-dollar question that this new generation is facing, RJ, is can you separate the art and the artist? And you do your best throughout the book without ignoring the misdeeds and making the argument that the music is going to be immortal. But for some of my students, they don't want to hear it. Boom.
Yeah. Yeah. And I would never say that they have to feel any other way. Mm-hmm. It's a personal decision and it's a personal response. And how can you argue with that any more than you can argue with, well, I like You Never Can Tell, but I don't like Johnny B. Goode or something. It hits you where all of us live. So I have a lot of respect for anybody's feelings on these matters.
Well, because ultimately they're taking pop music seriously, which is what the three of us have spent our lives doing, yeah. You know?
Yeah. But that is nonetheless an important context to put him in, both contexts as a creative force worth reckoning with and a person who did awful things to people who didn't deserve to have awful things done to them.
But the music touches us so very deeply. Let's go to the music. Yeah. Take us to Chess Studios when Ida Red becomes Ida May becomes Maybelline.
Yeah. So in East St. Louis, across the river from St. Louis, Chuck and Johnny Johnson and the group were playing shows night after night. You know, they're mixing up the blues. Chuck loved country music. He was a deep radio listener. That was his number one education, was listening to the radio and the music on the radio. And he wanted to bring country music in to the mix. So he's listening and just kind of throwing off these off-the-cuff versions of country songs he knew, like Ida Red, a Western swing song. And the audience is reacting. It's an African-American audience, and then whites are starting to come to after that. He's mixing up the crowd. They're responding. That's great for Chuck. That's great for everybody. So then he goes to that. That's his number one most requested number. Yeah. He takes that to Chess, and they get into it in the studio. You know, they're doing dozens of takes. Leonard is trying to figure out what he wants. We got to rewrite the song enough that it's an original now and not a cover, because people don't want covers, and there's more money if it's an original. How country to make it? How rhythm and blues to make it? They don't know until they hear it and they go, well, I like that one better than this one. Let's do that one again more next time. That was the first experience like that for Chuck and Johnny Johnson, and except for the Chess guys who were around there who'd done it many times. So it was a trial and error thing, even for Leonard Chess, because he hadn't had quite that experience of country music before and bringing it together in the mix. Mm-hmm. So they were groping in the dark and yelling at each other.
Yeah.
Maybelline, why can't you be true? Oh, Maybelline, why can't you be true? You done started doing the things you used to do. As I was motivating over the hill, I saw Maybelline in a coupe de ville. A Cadillac rolling on an open road, nothing out of run my vehicle. A Cadillac doing about 95, moves bumper to bumper, rolling side to side. Maybelline.
Well, you know, the thing that's fascinated me about your telling of the Maybelline evolution of how that came to be was that Chuck loved country music, A. B, he recognized that the so-called black crowd was loving country music, too. They loved dancing to it. They were doing country dances to it. So this kind of, you know, we like to silo off the races and the genres, and they were having none of it back then. And yeah. B, the calculation that went into Chuck's methodology of like the song's evolution, what people are responding to this, therefore I will give them more of it. You know, it's kind of like, you know, the two went hand in hand, the audience response to something that he clicked on. So he was an incredibly astute guy, even at that early stage. He was already figuring out how to move a crowd, right?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. He just had the radar on in a way that I don't, you know, nobody, not Elvis, nobody had the radar on any more loudly and fully as Chuck did. And he just sized up an audience so powerfully, quickly, and he noticed their response, and he knew how to titrate a little bit more of this, a little less of that. So and he didn't question it. He thought about it later, and why country, and what am I doing with the races, and but he just in the moment, you know, he gave the crowd what he wanted and what they wanted.
Yeah.
I mean, he was reaching for a teen audience. He was a 29-year-old guy when Maybelline hit. He was reaching for a white and black audience when he couldn't drive across St. Louis safely, necessarily. He saw this bigger picture that he gave us all, and at the same time, he wasn't always a part of that picture.
Coming up next, we talk about the role Berry's collaborators played in his career. That's in a minute on Sound Opinions. Remember in 2018 when Border Patrol separated thousands of refugee kids from their parents, deported those parents back to their home countries, and kept the kids in the United States? Believe it or not, 6 years later, there are still hundreds of families who have not yet been reunited.
Though we as a community may feel hopeless at times, we recently learned about an organization called Al Otro Lado, which works to reunify families. They provide holistic legal and humanitarian support to refugees, deportees, and other migrants in the U.S. and Tijuana through a multidisciplinary, client-centered, harm-reduction-based practice.
Since 2018, they've reunited over 100 refugee families ripped apart by the zero-tolerance policy of the previous administration. Once reunited, Al Otro Lado helps each family find legal representation, housing, and the counseling they need in order to heal and get back on their feet.
Imagine having your child ripped from your arms and never knowing when you would see them again. We can't let family separations go on. If you're like us and believe that all families belong together, then join us supporting Al Otro Lado and donate today.
You can find the link to donate to Al Otro Lado in the description of this episode, or go to gum.fm/charity and donate today. That's gum.fm/charity.
You can also consider volunteering with the organization, which offers opportunities that are both in-person and virtual. The best way to get involved is by filling out an application on their website, alotrolado.org/volunteer.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
And we're back. This week, we're talking with R.J. Smith about his biography of Chuck Berry.
You mentioned the name Johnny Johnson. A formative part, this keyboardist of Berry's sound, who only got recognized as such, you know, late in his life. There was a late career renaissance. Mm-hmm. I remember seeing Johnny play at that point. Just fantastic. And you have such a loving Chuck, who was suspicious of anyone. Most of all, those people who would claim any part of the greatness of Chuck, right? There was a fondness, even in the court case Johnson brought late in life to get songwriting credit. You know, Berry disrespected Keith Richards, who was funding and making happen a love letter film, Hail, Hail, Rock and Roll. You know, but he always had something for Johnny Johnson.
Yeah. Yeah, that's it. That's it. I mean, and that says, well, it says so much valuable about Chuck, and that he sorted stuff out, the personal from the business. He knew he could do business with Leonard Chess, and he found him. Trustworthy is not exactly the right word, but he knew he could do business and honest in all kinds of ways. And Johnny, he saw the big heart Johnny had and the great musicianship he had. Even when even when Johnny took him to court late in life and too late for it to do him any good, Chuck sorted it all out. And he said, well, that's business. And Chuck had taken people to court many times, and he knew what a good guy Johnny was, and they never lost that friendship.
Well, at the same time, RJ, I've got this anecdote about Chuck. He played a club in Chicago circa 1990 or so. And it was one of those, you know, ad hoc deals where the band gets hired, you know, Chuck meets the band, well, or they meet him before the show. He expects them to know his music.
What are you going to play? And Chuck Berry music.
But Johnny Johnson had opened the show. And I talked to Johnny, you know, prior to the show, and, you know, he was very excited because I think he'd just gotten that record deal where, you know, he was finally getting some recognition on his own.
After driving a bus for decades.
Correct. And so Johnny says, I'm kind of looking forward to it because I think, you know, Chuck and I probably play, you know, it'll probably be really cool that, you know, we're on the same bill together. This wasn't like a tour or anything. It was a one-off thing in Chicago, or two-night stand, actually. And I see Johnny there, and I say hello to him before the show, and he plays his set, and it's great. And then he's sitting there in the hallway leading up to the stage after his set, because Chuck's going to come out of the dressing room. So I'm sitting there with Johnny, and Chuck walks out of the dressing room to take the stage with his guitar in hand. He'd gotten the money up front, like he always did.
Cash on the barrel.
I think it was $20,000 that night. And Chuck doesn't even give him a hello, you know, not even a glance, just blows by, does his set, ignores Johnny the whole night. He knows Johnny's there, obviously, but he had nothing to do with him. I mean, literally did not say a word to him. And I go, what the hell was that? And poor Johnny was just crushed, you know, just shaking his head like, what, you know, he didn't understand it either, you know. And the set was kind of a train wreck, to be honest with you, too. The band got berated all night long, and Chuck was in a bad mood. But it was an interesting relationship, to say the least, between those two gentlemen, because in your book you make it very clear that a lot of the songs with that group of musicians he was working with out of the St. Louis clubs, a lot of that was collaborative. They were jamming stuff as opposed to Chuck writing the song, bringing it in, here, play my song. It was, yeah, let's work this out together. He needed those guys to bounce off of. What are we going to come up with here, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It was a group effort. And Chuck, it was Chuck's group, and he led the effort, and he came with ideas, as did Johnny. And they started with a blues song and ended up with something else after, you know, dozens of versions. And, well, what if we do this, and changing the lyrics and making an original. And that's how they started early on. And then they got well past that kind of model. But James Brown had a similar method. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm sure the Rolling Stones had a similar method. The law is one thing, but the creative process is different than that.
Yeah, no kidding. The language of rock and roll was created by Chuck. I think just reading your book just reaffirms that for me. These songs were mixing and matching genres and creating something new, but also the language itself. The there's never been a lyricist on that level. It's certainly in that first generation of rock and rollers that I can think of that's anywhere close to what he was doing with the lyrics. And also speaking in code to the black audience, you know, that stuff too. I think you address that with a number of those songs.
But making sure to enunciate, right, which he got from Nat King Cole, right? I want every word, roll over Beethoven,
diction,
you know, to be understood.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I talked to a number of musicians and songwriters and in different country and alt rock and everything. And I talked to a songwriter, great musician out here now, Ben Vaughn. And Ben talked about coming up in Philadelphia in the rock bar scene and you know, loving Chuck and doing Chuck songs. And he learned, you know, to do Johnny B. Goode, if you just added a syllable like, you know, a well-a or a, and then a, you would be lost because everything is so precise. If you drop a word or add a syllable, the rhythm is, you've thrown yourself off the train. So not only did the words have power and meaning and complexity, but they had to hit exactly right to the beat. Otherwise, you couldn't play that music.
Deep down in Louisiana, close to New Orleans, way back up in the woods among the evergreens, there stood a log cabin made of earth and wood, where lived a country boy named Johnny B. Goode, who never ever learned to read or write so well, but he could play a guitar just like a ring in a bell. Go, go.
The thing that's fascinating is after the first stint in jail, unlike Elvis, right, who really had to struggle back after the Army, Jerry Lee Lewis, his career is derailed, right, by Myra Gale's marriage becoming public. You know, Berry does his time and comes back with songs and recordings that, whatever we think of My Ding-a-ling, you know, are as strong as the first round.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. The Promised Land, You Never Can Tell, you know, No Particular Place to Go, Nadine.
C'est la vie, c'est the old folks, the culture show you never can tell. They had a high-five phone, oh boy, did they let it blast.
Yeah. Those are as good as anything he ever did, 64, 65, 66, And they were acknowledged at the time. They were hits, but his moment was changing, and the pop moment itself was changing. And he was like, went from being a founder to being this kind of flavor in the mix, and it had to mess with him.
Yeah, it had to. Well, and he doesn't help it by his stinginess, if we want to call it that. I think that's what it was, cheapness, right? He pulls into town. The promoters lined up a quartet. He doesn't even give them a set list. He doesn't rehearse. Goes on stage. And, you know, there's partly a joy to watch him move in that era on video, and I saw him a few times. I mean, he's conducting these band, he doesn't even know these people's names, right? You know, with a foot or an arm or even a look, he is telling them where they better go, right? And it's so fascinating to watch him. But you imagine, like, what if he'd played with real musicians? What if there'd still been a Johnny Johnson? Well, you know, Keith Richards would have been happy to play with him, you know, whenever the Stones weren't doing anything, which was often.
Yeah. I mean, there was a talk, sir, I don't know how serious the talk was, but there was a time when they were talking about the Stones and Chuck doing a tour together, but not even as, I think not even as like opener and headliner, but doing stuff together on a stage. And that would have just been, well, who knows what it would have been, but I would have loved to have heard it.
Yeah, well, we saw Prince, you know, do that with the likes of Chaka Khan and, you know, others.
It would have been amazing. But, you know, to me, you're right, RJ, with the period in the mid-60s where he came out of prison with that batch of at least five amazing songs that, you know, are as good as anything he'd ever done. And you quote this... the Baltimore Afro-American newspaper about this period where, you know, Chuck was out of prison, starting to tour, releasing this amazing music, and they're just saying, you know, where are the Beatles getting their stuff from? The Mercy Sound is a weak, pallid imitation of our lusty, homegrown rock and roll, but it's just that weakness that has made it pay off for the Beatles, while the innovators like Barry et al. Cash in far less on far more talent. You quote it, you don't really remark on it, but I'm curious about your feeling about that. The Beatles and the Stones and many others riding his coattails, right? I mean, and eclipsing one of the best periods in Chuck's life as a songwriter.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, if in the movie of his story, of this book that I have in my head, you know, there's a scene. He's in prison in 63, and he was working at a hospital at a prison in the federal system, and he's working. And you know, maybe he's helping get a mobster into the whirlpool or something, and there's a radio on in the room, and it's Top 40, and he hears the Beach Boys Surfing USA. Which is a straight up, as they later acknowledged, borrowing, ripoff of a Chuck Berry song. What would he have felt? What did he say or think at that moment? And there are plenty of those moments because and the British acts, the Beatles, the Stones, all, you know, the Kinks, so many, the hundreds of covers of Chuck Berry music and borrowings. They tended to be incredibly upfront about it. They paid him tribute in interviews and not from the stage. They gave him songwriting credits for his songs, and they wanted to play with him and meet him. So there's that. But and it made him a richer man. But how could it not make him feel conflicted and bad that this scene and this sound and this pop world and this audience that he created, he was not really able to fully be a part of.
Mm-hmm.
It created some intense, complicated feelings.
Well, yeah, and I'm wondering if this ties in with what we were talking about, sort of with the pickup bands. that he kind of got disheartened.
Yeah.
Like, I'm just going to get my money and I'm going to get in and out of here. You guys don't deserve me because I've been cheated all my life and I'm getting cheated again. I will not get cheated. And I'm also not going to give you, I'm not going to put my heart and soul into this performance. I'm going to give you exactly what you pay me for and not anything more than that.
I mean,
and it led to sort of a cynicism that really guided the last few decades of his life as a performer, I think.
Yeah, I definitely think that's a big part of, and that's where he made his living in the last few decades of his career was on the road. But also I also kind of feel like and there was this drama kind of like, okay, these guys are not the Magic. I'm the Magic. And he would have an argument, you know, maybe he'd wait and not go on stage until they threw a couple thousand more into the guitar case before he went on. And everyone would be mad and waiting and it's looking bad. But then Chuck would come out and anytime, more or less, anytime he wanted to, or many many times he proved, he put on a great show. There was a drama about overcoming the odds, overcoming all this lousy stuff which was set up by him, and at the end of the night, having the crowd love him and screaming for an encore that he might not give.
Encores cost extra.
That's right. So he could win your heart over on any time he wanted to, pretty much, with a pickup band that he disrespected and without a rehearsal. What are we going to play? Chuck Berry music. It was like a drama that appealed to him and audiences. You know, some of those shows were great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He liked messing with people. RJ, I go back to the most profound sentence in the book. Racism and sexual freedom fused. To what extent was his victimization of women, often white women, to what extent were these things fused? Do you think? I mean, you had to live with this ugliness, which I know is particularly painful. You love the music and you hate these things you're discovering as a reporter, the way he treated people, women. Where did it come from?
Yeah, there's a lot in there, and I have some ideas, and people help steer me with their own ideas about it, but you never totally know. There's an amazing scene in a BBC documentary, not even documentary, it was like a half hour, amazing. It was around the time of my ding-a-ling. He was doing more interviews, being much more happy and candid. And he let this British crew travel on the road with him. And he's playing, I think, Palo Alto, pickup band. And they only show a little bit of this, but he's berating the harmonica player, looked like a white college kid, and blues fan, and he's doesn't like what he's playing, and he's soloing at the wrong time, and he puts his arm around him on the stage in front of this largely white audience, I believe Palo Alto, and he says, basically, isn't this amazing? You know, his grandparents called my grandparents boy and property. And isn't it amazing that I can be up here today and tell him what to do and what not to do, and you guys have to love it. That's that opened a window up for me.
Wow. Yeah,
that's amazing. that's something. I want to get back to the music just briefly, because just as a reminder, because we're so conflicted about this guy.
So
for a brief moment, indulge us, RJ. You've studied this guy as much as anybody that I know. If you were to point one of those skeptical millennials toward, okay, I know you think he's a despicable person, probably true in one sense. What about the music? What song would you say? Well, first of all, can you just listen to this, though?
Yeah.
What would it be and why?
Well, I wouldn't want to live in a world without Chuck's music in it, personally. And I hope that comes across. He shaped the world I live in, and he made it a better place in lots of ways that, you know, it probably helped not to cross paths with him on a personal level somewhat, to be able to have that experience and to feel the way that I just expressed. What song, you know, The Promised Land, 1965, is a really, it's a great forward-looking number. It seems to point towards singer-songwriters and Creedence Clearwater Revival as an optimism. It is only half secretly looking at the Freedom Rides, looking at the civil rights movement in the South, sung by a character in the song trying to get out of the South, trying to get to the Promised Land. Obviously a religious concept, referring to the religious hymns that were transformed by the civil rights movement, the mm-hmm. Promised Land. It's not a gospel number, but it's in the key of a gospel number somehow. Mm-hmm. And the places he mentions in the song, he's going on this epic journey through the South to get out of the South. He references places that maybe just sound like places on a map to a listener such as myself growing up hearing them, but had specific resonance to anybody who lived or knows about the civil rights struggle in the South and the Freedom Rides, where people were going by bus from the North to the South to help integrate public spaces. So, and he ends up in the Promised Land of California, which is a whole another set of issues. But he always had this warm feeling for California and for leaving home for a place that was better than home. And that song is full of all that stuff.
Somebody help me get out of Louisiana, just help me get to Houston town. There are people there who care a little about me and they won't let the poor boy down. Sure as you bone, they bought me a silk suit, put luggage in my hand, and I woke up high over Albuquerque on a jet to the Promised Land.
The book opens with his love of Cadillacs, but it ends, RJ, with him having to drive a Toyota because he's too often pulled yeah. over, even being, you know, a 70-year-old worldwide famous if he's driving the Cadillac.
Yeah, that was so amazing to me. And I mean, in a way, that's sort of the through line of the book about Chuck is mobility and teenage mobility. We, you know, the leaving home, going to a better place, the freedom to hot rod, all that stuff that so many songs and so many teenage, you know, rhapsodies have been written about. But And there's all kinds of resonance for African Americans, the Green Book, and wanting to be as good as anybody else when you're driving a fast car. And at the end of his life, you know, as he said to a reporter interviewing him, I love cars. I have a barn full of cars. And the car mattered as much to him as anything in life, as much as his guitar. But when he drove around town, he didn't drive the Cadillac necessarily, because he would get pulled over. So he drove that car that fit in.
But one of the caddies is now in the Smithsonian.
And
his song has gone to space.
It's gone to space.
So, you know, RJ, a really important book, Chuck Berry, An American Life, and the subtitle is really the only thing you can say, right? This is 100% an American life, for good and for bad. Now the author of two of our favorite music books of all time, the one about James Brown and this one, you know, I think this book's going to have a long and in some ways sad life. RJ, because as people come to terms with what he did as a man and what he created as an artist, it's going to go in and out of fashion. But it was necessary. I mean, this is going to be the one to read in 2099 if you want to figure out who Chuck Berry was.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing.
Well, that's awesome. Well, thank you. And yeah, I mean, I feel like more than we even know, you know, that the art that we like, the writers we like, the friends we have are complicated people, and they're not all one thing or the other.
Right.
And we're all going through this intense internet-fed and internet-poisoning process of kind of coming to terms with what that means. But I wouldn't want to live without him.
It was great stuff, RJ. We have been talking to RJ Smith, the author of Chuck Berry and American Life. Thank you so much, RJ, for the discussion.
Oh, Jim and Greg, thank you so much.
That wraps up our conversation with R.J. Smith. And as always, now we want to hear from you. What do you think of Chuck Berry? Leave us a voice message on our website, soundopinions.org, with your thoughts. Mr. Cott, what do we have on the show next week?
Next week, Jim, we have a very busy man on the show, Jason Isbell. He's got a new album, and he's got a new documentary film. We're going to talk to him about all of those things.
What a great guest.
And do not forget to check out our bonus podcast feed wherever you get your podcasts.
The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this program belong solely to Sound Opinions and not necessarily to Columbia College Chicago or our sponsors. Thanks, as always, to our Patreon supporters. Sound Opinions is produced by Andrew Gill, Alex Claiborne, and our associate producer, Sol Delgadillo. Our social media consultant is Katie Cott.
Never get to sleep. There's a hole inside you, feeling. Shower up and shave. Put flowers on the grave and ask the Lord to save us. 20